So yesterday, as you recall, we looked at a couple of the signs or allegories that Jeremiah uses. As we said, there are many of them. We couldn't possibly cover them all in a couple of days here. So we selected two to focus on yesterday. As you recall, they were the old paths and also the potter and the clay. So this morning, we would like to conclude our classes on Jeremiah, the prophet and the man of God, and looking in some detail at this real people, the Rechabites, and we'll definitely be considering them as such. But the reason that's mentioned in Jeremiah is there is a lesson. Just like all of these, there's a very important lesson, or perhaps more than one lesson, regarding the Rechabites. And we find they're being mentioned, and we'll just read to begin the first two verses of Jeremiah 35. But that's where we find the record of this people and the parable of the Rechabites. The word which came unto Jeremiah from the Lord in the days of Jehoiakim, the son of Josiah, king of Judah, saying, Go unto the house of the Rechabites, and speak unto them, and bring them into the house of the Lord into one of the chambers, and give them wine to drink. Very interesting. Now we are familiar with this passage. We are familiar with the Rechabites and the test that's mentioned at the end of verse 2 when they were offered wine to drink. But to fully appreciate everything that is involved here, in these few verses in chapter 35 of Jeremiah, concerning this people, in particular the lessons that should be taken from them, we want to take a few minutes now to look into the background of this people, for their story indeed is both interesting and very significant in terms of the history of God's people. So we ask these questions: where did they come from? Who were their ancestors? Well, the history of this people, believe it or not, goes back to the time of Jethro and Jethro himself. We are very familiar with Jethro. So what we'd like to do is start here and trace the history of the Rechabites. Their connection, what we will find, is a very strong connection with God's people. Because again, it's a very interesting story. So Jethro, again, we know who he was, who he is in the story of God's people, the father-in-law of Moses, the father of Zipporah, the wife of Moses. We know that Jethro was a man, it seems, understood the ways of God. We can say with some confidence that in fact he was a preacher of righteousness among the Midianites. Particularly, we find evidence of his faithfulness at the time when he brings Zipporah and their children, that is, Moses and her children, to rejoin Moses in the wilderness. This is in Exodus chapter 18. If you'll turn with me there, we want to read a few verses relative to the faithfulness of Jethro. So to set the context, in verse 1, Exodus 18, when Jethro, the priest of Midian, Moses' father-in-law, heard of all that God had done for Moses and for Israel, his people, and that the Lord had brought Israel out of Egypt. Then down to verse 5, and Jethro, Moses' father-in-law, came with his sons and his wife unto Moses into the wilderness, where he encamped at the Mount of God. In verse 7, and Moses went out to meet his father-in-law and did obeisance and kissed him. And they asked each other of their welfare, and they came into the tent. And Moses told his father-in-law all the Lord had done unto Pharaoh and to the Egyptians for Israel's sake, and all the travail that had come upon them by the way, and how the Lord delivered them. And Jethro rejoiced. He rejoiced for the goodness all the goodness which the Lord had done to Israel when he had delivered them out of the hand of the Egyptians. And Jethro said, blessed be the Lord, who hath delivered you out of the hand of the Egyptians and out of the hand of Pharaoh, have delivered the people from under the hand of the Egyptians. Now I know, this is Jethro speaking, now I know that the Lord is greater than all gods, for in the thing wherein they dealt proudly, he was above them. And most significantly, for this will come up later, and Jethro, Moses' father-in-law, took a burnt offering and sacrifices for God, and Aaron came and all the elders of Israel to eat bread with Moses, father-in-law, before God. Now, a few verses later, in this same chapter, we find Jethro giving counsel to his son-in-law. Again, there's a lot of significance here in terms of the knowledge of this man and his wisdom. What he basically does, without reading this whole section of verses 17 to 24, just to highlight a couple of things, he recognizes that the situation with Moses trying to be leader and judge of all the people, he says, that thou doest not good. You're trying to do too much, Moses. So effectively, he says, you shouldn't be trying to do this whole job yourself. You need to delegate. And that's the advice he gives them, to delegate the responsibility of judging the people, particularly in the smaller matters, to others, so that you can do your job better as leader of the children of Israel. The most important question we need to ask at this point in regard to our subject, was this man, this faithful Jethro, was he actually a Midianite, or did he come from another people by heritage? We find the answer in Judges chapter 1 and verse 16. And the children of the Kenite, Moses' father-in-law, says, went up out of the city of palm trees with the children of Judah into the wilderness of Judah, which lieth in the south of Arad. And they went and dwelt among the people. So here we see a connection between Jethro, Moses' father-in-law, and the Kenites. So the question then, is it possible that Jethro was actually a Kenite living in the land of Midian? Well, what we just read in Judges chapter 1 seems to say this. So we can see now the beginnings of a strong affinity, if this is the case, between the children of Israel and the Kenites. But what we read at the end of that verse is particularly significant. For it says that the descendants of Jethro went up and dwelt among the people of Judah. What it is saying is that some of the Kenites went with the children of Israel after the conquest of the land. And very likely, as we'll mention in a moment, were among them earlier. So again, what we see, brothers and sisters, is the beginning of a close and friendly association between God's chosen people and this people, the Kenites. And where did they live? Well, as we show on this slide, they were down. Okay, so if Jethro was down in the land of Midian, it says they had gone up, that is, they moved north into the area of the Negev, which we know became part of the land of Judah, southern Judah, residing with them at this point. The most important and unusual aspect, if we really start looking, and we won't review their entire history, was their association not only with the children of Israel, but with others. And it was most often the case, not always, but most often that was peaceful. And certainly that was the case with their association with the children of Israel. They usually appear as simple, harmless strangers and nomads, being on good terms with their neighbors and not entering into their conflicts. So we can say at this point, and we will confirm it as we go through, it seems that they were a unique and special people, set apart from the other Gentile nations. Another very interesting reference to the Kenites is in chapter 24 of Numbers. And in that chapter, we have the parables of Balaam. And we just want to focus on one verse that speaks of the Kenites. And he, that is Balaam, looked on the Kenites and took up his parable and said, relative to the Kenites, strong is thy dwelling place, and thou puttest thy nest in a rock, or other versions such as the Revised Standard say, the rock. Puttest thy nest in the rock. So where, when he was looking at these Kenites, where was he looking? Well, again, he was looking at down upon them, and we believe at this point, and we're backing up at time, that some of them had accompanied Israel as they wandered in the wilderness. For this is the context of this parable. So if he is looking at the Kenites that were with Israel at this time, it adds a deeper meaning to this parable. What does it mean to be, when it says, strong is thy dwelling place, and thou puttest thy nest in the rock? What stronger place could one be than with the children of God? If the Kenites were dwelling amongst the children of Israel, how very appropriate this parable would be. Indeed, there is no stronger dwelling place than to be among, dwelling with, the Rock of Israel. And now we ask, should the Kenites not have joined in more completely with Israel? We said they tended to be separate, strangers in the land wherever they were. So why didn't they associate themselves even more living with the Israelites? Wouldn't this have been expected of faithful strangers seeking after the one true God? Wouldn't they even have been expected to help fight in the battles and all the wars as they conquered the land? It doesn't say anything about that. Well, I think they were smarter than this. They were wise in not having a stronger association with the children of Israel because they were very observant. If they were wandering with the children of Israel, what would they have observed? They would have observed one time after another that God's people were disobeying Yahweh of Israel. Do I want to be more associated with such rebellious people? Perhaps not, and so that seems to be the case. Any Kenites that were with them would have witnessed the disobedience, the whole sad picture from the golden calf on. So the Kenites may well have felt, because of Israel's proneness to rebellion, proneness to idolatry, it would be better to, we can dwell among them, but maintain separateness, distinction as their own people. Consequently, when the tribes were settled into their respective inheritances in the land, the Kenites moved to the far southern end of Judah, as we just mentioned, into the wilderness area of south of Arad. Now, it's not until 150 years later, but still in the period of the Judges, referring back to Judges 1 and 16, where we observe the connection with Jethro, that we hear of the Kenites again. Now we're in chapter 4 of Judges, where we read of one Heber, the Kenite. And we know this story. Now there is a little, if we go back to our chart here, so we have Jethro, where it starts, and then Hobad, and then this particular place, that is Judges chapter 4 and verse 11, it actually refers to the children of Hobab, the father-in-law of Moses. Now what we really think it's saying is that Hobab was actually the son of Jethro, which would make him the brother-in-law of Moses and not directly his father-in-law. And so the son of Hobab is this man Heber that we read about here in Judges chapter 4. And we are very familiar with this story and who Heber's wife was, one Jael. And we're familiar with that. But again, we want to focus on these Kenites now at the time of Heber, who was a Kenite. So it says in Judges 4:11 that he separates himself from the Kenites and pitches his tent on the plain of Zaanan, which is near Laish, a city of Dan. Now this is interesting because where is Dan located? All the way up north. All right. We just said they had moved from the land of Midian, Jethro's day, and perhaps some who traveled with them in the wilderness also settled in Arad and the Negev. Now, we don't know why this particular Kenite moved from the extreme south to the extreme north of Israel. We don't know the reason, but based on the rest of the story, we can safely say it was providential. One thing we can say is that once again, we see the characteristics of this people. They chose not to live in the midst of the people, that is, around Jerusalem or the more populated areas where the Israelites lived, but in the less frequented border areas of the land. We also note that it mentions that he dwelt in a tent. At this point, most of the Israelites, as we know, when they settled in the land, where did they go? They went to dwell in the cities and the houses built by the Canaanites. The Kenites were then, again, more true strangers and sojourners. And here's one of our lessons. Here we find a Gentile people who were actually following the ways of Abraham, the fathers of Israel, more so than the children of Israel at this time. Strangers and sojourners as such in the land. The next mention of the Kenites is in 1 Samuel 15, where we find them now, interestingly enough. Where are they dwelling now at this particular time, at least some of them? Among the Amalekites. So the context here is Saul is commanded by God to destroy the Amalekites. But before he does this, he does something very interesting and pretty unusual for this man, Saul. He goes to the trouble to warn the Kenites who were dwelling among the Amalekites at this time to get out of harm's way before he attacked. And why would Saul do such a thing? The answer is in verse 6, where it says, "Ye," that is the Kenites, "showed kindness to all the children of Israel when they came up out of Egypt." So here's further evidence that at least some of them were with the children of Israel when they left Egypt and went with them into the wilderness. But they showed kindness. So here is a reward for that kindness. Saul kept them from being slaughtered along with the Amalekites. But the message here again is the Kenites wanted peace. They didn't want to participate in the battle. This time among the fierce and warlike Amalekites, a bitter enemy of Israel. A little later, when David is delivering the spoils of the Amalekites to the cities that had befriended him when he was a fugitive from Saul, we find the cities of the Kenites among those that receive spoils. And that was in 1 Samuel 30 and 29. So this would be an indication that the sympathies of the Kenites were also with David, who would, as we know, become king of Israel. So again, we just want to emphasize there's something special, something very special about this people. Their simple and separate way of life that insulated the Kenites from the conflicts of the times wherever they were. And let's think about us. Okay, here we have a people who led a simple life. They didn't have very much. They lived in tents. They would pick up and go somewhere with their few belongings to another place. They had little to covet. And so, if we think about ourselves and our lives, are we more likely to be left in peace if we live simple lives, if we have little to covet, and to be at peace with those around us? I think so. Now we come to the two most interesting and instructive episodes of this people's long and unique history, and where we discover their connection with the Rechabites, and we're going to get back to Jeremiah 35 here in a minute. So another 150 years goes by when the first of these two incidents occurs. In 2 Kings chapter 10, we are introduced to a man named Jehonadab, later known as Jonadab, the son of Rechab. We are told in 2 Kings 10 that he was a leader of the Kenites. And based on the subsequent history concerning him and his outstanding character, we believe that this man was widely known and respected as a righteous man. And as we will learn, he left a deep impression on his people. Such a deep impression that the commandments that he gave them would be continually kept, faithfully kept, for at least 250 years. So here in 2 Kings 10, we find Jehonadab coming to meet the king of Israel, Jehu, at this time. He was coming to assist him in carrying out the instructions given by Elisha to execute judgment on the house of wicked King Ahab. We read of the encounter in verse 15. When Jehu was on his way from Jezreel to Samaria, it says, he lighted on Jehonadab, the son of Rechab, coming to meet him. And upon their meeting, we find Jehu saluting this man, Jehonadab, and he asked him a very pointed and telling question. He asked him, is thy heart right as my heart is with thy heart? And we skipped over his answer in our quote on the slide, but it said, his answer was emphatically, literally translated from the Hebrew, it is, my heart is right. Not only, you know, with him, of course, we know with his God. Jehu then requests that he give him his hand, as if he was asking, are you with me? Are you with me in the destruction of Ahab's house and Baal worship, as I am with you in the worship of the one true God of Israel? He responds again by giving him his hand as Jehu pulls him up into the chariot. Then Jehu proceeds to deceive the worshipers of Baal. They are all slaughtered, as they are called, as we won't get into the actual story here, but we recall that there was a supposed sacrifice to the false god. When they came, they were all killed. And then we read in verse 23 of this same chapter how Jehonadab goes with Jehu into the house of Baal, working together with him in this deception. But Jehonadab was likely disappointed now. He would have likely expected further reformations to occur at the hand of King Jehu. But that was not to be the case, as we know. We find Jehu ruling Israel in wickedness. He begins himself, ironically, he begins to promote idol worship. He, you know, destroys those of the Baal worshipers and then proceeds to promote idol worship himself. So what a contrast then between these two men. It seems Jehu liked to fight for God, but he didn't live for him. He never internalized the war and slaughter of the Baal worshipers to fight against his own evil desires. On the other hand, contrasting, we find Jonadab, who saw clearly the evils of Ahab and Jezebel, the downfall of Jehu, and he established principles in his life that prevented him and his family from being lost. And you notice there's been a theme here, hasn't there, throughout our classes, and that is concern for one's family. You know, we saw it certainly with Shaphan and all those examples of his sons and grandsons. We saw it with Jethro and, you know, the development of his people, the Kenites, and now the house of Rechab. And we see it with the father of the Rechabites, certainly, in the case of Jonadab. So now we come specifically to the connection between the Rechabites and the Kenites. Going back to our family tree of the Rechabites here, starting with Jethro, as we get down to the bottom, it says, Rechab, here we see that Rechab descended from Heber the Kenite, and Jonadab was the son of Rechab. Now it's in 1 Chronicles chapter 2, where we have proof of this connection, that is between the house of Rechab and the Kenites. At the very end of the chapter, let's turn that up. So we're looking at 1 Chronicles chapter 2 now. The last verse. Verse 55. So it's addressing here the families of the scribes which dwelt at Jabez. And at the end of the verse, it says, it mentions several names, and then it says, these are the Kenites that came of Hemath, the father of the house of Rechab. So these scribes came from the house of Rechab. So summarizing again a little bit about this people. Throughout their history, we find the Kenites and now the house of Rechab, that they were pastoral people, choosing the open country and tent life. But there is no indication, we shouldn't conclude from this, that they were in any way backward or ignorant, because now we find some of them were scribes. Very interesting. As we know, scribes were very learned people, associated with the study and teaching of the laws of God. All right, now we're back, finally, in Jeremiah 35. Having traced the history of the Kenites and the Rechabites, we return to the story and the allegory of Jeremiah. Brothers and sisters, it is here that the prophet provides us with some very powerful, some very exhortive lessons concerning this people, and specifically this man Jonadab and his house. As we read on in this chapter, we find a very detailed and intimate picture of this unique people. Now, another 250 years has gone by after the time of Jonadab. It takes place during the reign of wicked Jehoiakim, very near the end of the kingdom of Judah, as the Babylonian army is already in the land. And at this time, a group of Kenites of the family of Rechab have taken temporary refuge from the Babylonians in Jerusalem. For 250 years, this family of the Kenites has been faithful and obedient to the instructions of their father, Jonadab. For 250 years, they have been a sign and a warning to Israel for anyone who had eyes or ears to perceive it. Clearly, Jonadab's purpose was to keep their lives simple and separate from the settled inhabitants of the land. For he knew the Israelites were so easily given, as we mentioned, and it continued to this day very much, given to idolatry and corruption. We find them encamped in Jerusalem at this time, at least the house of Rechab. But they would have been an object lesson, a wonderful object lesson for the people there, the children or the nation of Judah. They would have been in their way of life, they would have stood out as distinct, peculiar people. As such, again, they were an ideal subject for God to use as a lesson to his people through the prophet Jeremiah. And so we read in verse 2 of chapter 35 that God tells Jeremiah to bring the Rechabites to the temple and set wine before them, invite them to drink. And Jeremiah does as God instructs, as we read. And Jeremiah, hopefully you're there. Jeremiah 35. We didn't have verse 5 on the screen. That's what I want to read. And I set before the sons of the house of the Rechabites pots full of wine and cups. And I said unto them, drink ye wine. But verse 6 is most remarkable in terms of their response, and here's why God put them to this test. He knew what their response would be. We will drink no wine. Why? Because Jonadab, the son of Rechab, our father, commanded us not to drink. God knew the Rechabites would not drink the wine. And if we think about it, perhaps we have at least some portion of the Nazirite condition involved here. The Nazirite vow was to cause one to separate and abstain from the things of the world, and likewise devote oneself completely to the God of Israel. And so we think that this was the basis upon which Jonadab imposed it, if in fact he did, but at least this portion of the Nazirite vow on his people. And of course, in their case, there would have been no compulsion for the Kenites to take on this vow. They were not under the law of Moses. But Jonadab knew it was the right thing for them to do. What he wanted them to do, as they had always done, was to live in the land, but do so as strangers and sojourners. In fact, this is what we are told, the very thing we are told in verse 7 in this chapter, as we look down a couple of verses. And this is from another version. You shall not build a house, nor sow seed, nor plant a vineyard, nor have any of these, but all your days you shall dwell in tents, that you may live many days in the land where you are sojourners, or where you should be sojourners. We believe this shows that Jonadab had a clear understanding of the importance of righteousness for his family and his people. Righteous living in the land and a connection between it and their right to be there. You know what we're saying there? God always wanted his people to obey him. To remain in the promised land, that was a condition. If you obey me, you will live here and you can live here forever. If you disobey, out you go. Jonadab, it seems, understood that better than the children of Israel and certainly the nation of Judah at this time, despite the preaching of Jeremiah. Jonadab listened to Jeremiah, apparently. So unfortunately, the children of Israel most often lacked this understanding, the appreciation of the mercy of God in allowing them to maintain their inheritance as long as he did. Jonadab could see the children of Israel sinking deeper and deeper into the conditions of wickedness that God from the beginning had warned would bring their expulsion from the land and dispersion among the nations. Jonadab wanted to preserve his own people from such corruption and ensuing punishment. He also wanted them to be a wholesome example. Think about this lesson. He wanted his people to be an example. Example to the children of Israel around them, that if followed, might lead to the preservation of the whole nation. What a beautiful thought. He was concerned not only for his house, not only for his family, but the children of God around them. He wanted them to see what they were doing and follow suit. And should not that be the case with us? An example that might prolong God's mercy and his forbearance, even toward the children of Israel. So as we read, they had no vineyards, no conventional agriculture, leading a nomadic life as herdsmen and tent dwellers. A life of Abraham, faithful Abraham, no self-indulgences, few worldly possessions, no comfortable homes, truly strangers and pilgrims in the earth. Now, it's true, brothers and sisters, we live in different times, but shouldn't the same principles of living apply to us? It behooves us, as we live in corrupt times these last days ourselves, in the times of the Gentiles, to examine ourselves in the light of the things we've been talking about. God has entrusted us with so very much. What are we doing with what he has entrusted us? Are we squandering it for ourselves? Are we using it in God's service? Surely the Rechabites' way of life was much more than just blind submission to the laws of man or God. So we said Jonadab had a purpose in giving this commandment and others to them that he did 250 years before his time, this time. And certainly his faithful descendants recognized that purpose. For what does it say in verse 10? We had dwelt in tents and have obeyed and done according to all that Jonadab our father commanded us. We read again in verse 14 that the Rechabites had received and obeyed the words of their father. But it also says God's own people had not obeyed the words of their father in heaven. The children of Israel had not inclined their ears to the commands for them to repent of their idolatry and evil ways. As it says, they had not hearkened unto their God. And so in the closing words of Jeremiah 35, we have the wonderful reward pronounced by God himself for the faithfulness of the Rechabites, as we read on in verses 18 and 19. And Jeremiah said unto the house of the Rechabites, Thus saith the Lord of hosts, the God of Israel, because ye have obeyed the commandment of Jonadab your father, and kept all his precepts, and done according unto all that he hath commanded you. Therefore, thus saith the Lord of hosts, the God of Israel, Jonadab, the son of Rechab, shall not want a man to stand before me forever. What a beautiful promise. What a wonderful promise. Stand before God. Surely here it means more than under his care. In fact, it usually means to hold a position of responsibility in the work of Yahweh. It was used, for example, of the Levites as special ministers of God. So how appropriate then, as the Kenites and now the house of Rechab had become related to Israel in this way, blessed through their father Jonadab, who was so faithful himself. And what a blessing to be pronounced upon a man who was not directly under the covenants of promise. And we emphasize the word directly. Certainly, as we've said, they were a very unusual people. And this final scriptural statement concerning one of them is a unique and very high commendation from God himself, especially to a Gentile. Throughout their history, the Kenites and Rechabites kept this separate path, a Gentile people drawn to the children of Israel by the worship of their God. They were a people again, living a simple life, one at peace with their neighbors. But at certain times of crisis, and we think of Jael, they stepped in and they played a decisive role. The Kenites and the Rechabites were truly strangers and sojourners, sojourning in the land of promise as if it was a strange country, dwelling in tents. They too looked to a city, though. They looked to the future. They had a hope for the city that hath foundations, whose builder and maker is God. They too died in faith, just as Abraham, not having received the promises, but they saw them afar off. They were persuaded of them. They embraced them and confessed, "Indeed, we are strangers and pilgrims in this earth." And so we ask, is there a possibility of an eternal inheritance for this people? The blessing of Jonadab and the Rechabites that we just read in verse 19 does end with the word forever. So it seems that they are among what's described by Isaiah in chapter 56, among the sons of the stranger. Those who join themselves to the Lord, to serve Him, and to love the name of the Lord. And also talks about giving sacrifice, giving burnt offerings. When we think back, way back to Jethro and what he did. But the final thing it says in this description, and probably the most important in terms of their possible eternal inheritance, are five words: taketh hold of my covenant. Each of us have been given the opportunity, and we are in covenant relationship through Christ. The question for me and you is this: have we taken hold of it? Jehonadab did, taking hold of the covenant. We've got a few minutes left. I just a point of interest, going back to and relative to our next class. And apparently it's not, I know it's not in the King James, but Psalm 71 says a psalm of David, and this is the part that's in the Septuagint, of the sons of Jonadab and those led captive. And you see some really interesting parallels. I don't know if Brother Josh has looked into this, but so you look at verses 3 and 4 of Psalm 71 and compare some of the descriptions there to what we read in Numbers 24 concerning that parable of Balaam and the Kenites. A strong habitation in Psalm 71. Strong is thy dwelling place, he says about the Kenites, dwelling with the children of Israel. And he referred, "For thou art my rock and my fortress. Thou puttest thy nest in a rock." That's what he said about the Kenites. "Thou hast given commandment to save me," Psalm 71. in Numbers 24:23, "Alas, who shall live when God doeth this? Who shall be saved?" As we conclude, let us reflect again on the overall message of the prophet and man of God. And as we've said several times, it seems to be this: change. Change while there is still time. Repent before it is too late. The end is coming. So now we would like to conclude. Do I have any time left? A couple minutes, right? Anyway, it will just take a couple minutes. So some concluding thoughts concerning the life and times of Jeremiah. As we've said, they are similar to our own, and so there are many lessons that we can draw. He lived at an end of an age, as do we. He and his friends awaited the destruction of Jerusalem at the hand of the Babylonians. We await the destruction of this present order of things at the hands of the Messiah, as we heard last period. We, like Jeremiah and his friends, do not know what we may have to go through before the long-anticipated end comes. We pray we will remain faithful as did Jeremiah. Jeremiah lived in the midst of those who had turned their backs towards God and his word. They were referred to several times as his backsliding children. Jeremiah then exhorted his brothers and sisters to forsake the way in which they are walking and to walk rather in the light of the word. But we know his message went unheeded. And in fact, they opposed him vigorously. So we'd like to conclude by picturing a stage of the world at that time. In the backdrop, in the very big picture, we see restless movements of great nations, the Egyptians and the Babylonians, striving to work out their destinies. But as we draw closer to the stage, we see a pitiable spectacle of this little nation, the nation of Judah, God's people. Without any apparent remorse, the spark of her nationality is crushed. The glory of God's people from the days of Kings David and Solomon has all but disappeared. And then we look in the very middle of this scene, in their midst, and what do we see? We see this prophet, this man of God. Yah is righteousness. He became known as the suffering servant for good reason. Intense in his words and his actions, he had great clarity in his outlook as he strides confidently across the stage, no matter what is happening to him. He alone has a message from the one true God. He alone has the faith that can move mountains. But he can't move his own people, his hearers. He becomes remorseful. He suffers physically. He suffers mentally because his message is so strong and one which the people did not want to hear. But brothers and sisters, Jeremiah knew the scene would change one day. One day far into the future, it would become a scene of peace and safety in Jerusalem. Right, Brother Harold? It would become a scene of peace and safety in Jerusalem. He sees his Messiah reigning on the throne of King David, and he will experience the joy that only a true prophet can feel in the permanent and glorious prosperity of the people now known as true Israel. It is for them that this faithful remnant that he labored so long and so hard for, and at that future time, the time that we all long for, his lamentations will turn to songs of praise. I'd like to close with a very familiar reading from Lamentations chapter 3. If we turn with me there. beginning in verse 22. It is the Lord's mercies that we are not consumed, because His compassions fail not. They are new every morning. Great is Thy faithfulness. The Lord is my portion, saith my soul. Therefore will I hope in Him. The Lord is good unto them that wait for Him, to the soul that seeketh Him. It is good that a man should both hope and quietly wait for the salvation of the Lord. Before I step down, I too want to add my thanks to everyone here, and especially to the Bible School Committee and all the hard work, as the other brothers have said. Thank you very much.